Welcome to Healthy Her, the podcast designed to inspire women to lead lives filled with health and happiness. I'm Dr. Amy Brenner, your host discussing nutrition, hormones, aesthetics, sexual health, and more. Join us each week as we dive into feeling better, looking better, and living better. Welcome back to another episode of Healthy Her. And today we're going to talk about a really exciting procedure that I would bet most of you don't even know that this treatment even exists. So we have a special guest. His name is Dr. David Taube. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So before we get started, can we just give everybody a little background of who you are and why you're our expert talking about our non-invasive treatment for uterine fibroids?
Well, thank you so much. So I'm a gynecologist. I trained up in Boston and also here in Philadelphia. I was did a fellowship under someone named Harry Rich, who did the first laparoscopic hysterectomy on the planet, but also very importantly, did work with someone named Mickey Hutchins, who was one of the pioneers of hysterectomy alternatives. Very much got me turned on to that. In fact, for a while, Mickey and I were probably two of the only people in the Northeast United States who would offer women in their mid to late 40s hysterectomy alternatives, regardless of a desire for childbearing. And since April of 2008, I've been at Gynesonics, which is a startup in Silicon Valley. I'm now the senior vice president of medical affairs, but basically I'm a gynecologist. I provide a lot of clinical support to our great team. And what Gynesonics does is we have a device to treat uterine fibroids, which is a very common problem among women globally, but especially in women of color.
Yeah. So for those people that don't know what fibroids are, could you just give everybody a background of what are fibroids and what are the symptoms that somebody would have? How would they know they even have fibroids?
Certainly. So fibroids are benign tumors of the uterus. In fact, they're highly prevalent. We know that around almost 70% of white women and actually more than 80% of Black women will develop fibroids by the time they're age 50. Fortunately, many women do not develop symptoms, but probably anywhere from 20 to 50% of women do develop symptoms. They, most commonly have abnormal uterine bleeding. They can have painful intercourse. When fibroids are large, they cause what we call bulk symptoms, pressure on the bladder, pressure on the rectum, causing constipation in many cases. Women can present with urinary frequency, just like a urinary tract infection, but it's not an infection. It's really just a big fibroid pressing on their bladder. We believe it causes issues with fertility. It does certainly cause preterm labor, and it's just a huge issue. Again, very benign, but even though it's a benign problem, it causes immense hardship for millions of women on the planet, including a huge number of women in the U.S. And it's also the number one indication, unfortunately, for hysterectomy in this country. We still do a lot of hysterectomies in this country for women with fibroids. It can always be a woman's choice. Hysterectomy is complete removal of the uterus, but other than it being a woman's choice, it's rarely surgically necessary to do a hysterectomy for fibroids. And that's been even mentioned in the standard textbook of surgical gynecology by Tay Lind. And yet it seems to be a very controversial idea, even in 2023, that you don't need to do a hysterectomy for fibroids.
And things have certainly changed probably since you and I trained. I think back when I trained, and I would imagine probably similar to you trained, when women had fibroids, I would say the choices were you could go on birth control pills, or you could have an abdominal hysterectomy, or if your uterus was small enough, a vaginal hysterectomy. Those were the choices. Like laparoscopic hysterectomy was just starting to be performed when I was in residency. Did I miss anything way back when, or when our parents had these kinds of issues?
No, that's very much true. In fact, what was innovative at the time when I was a fellow, and then subsequently and attending physician at Pennsylvania Hospital, was to take a very novel, really homegrown instrument that had two needles on it that you could put into a fibroid laparoscopically or through an open, a laparotomy incision. And we thought back then that without any imaging involved, like ultrasound, et cetera, that we magically were destroying the blood supply to the fibroids. And my patients seemed to do better overall, but it certainly was not a very efficient or really effective way to treat fibroids. But at that time, that was one of the better options we had. And most gynecologists never had even heard of it at that point.
So how would women know if they have fibroids, if they have any of those symptoms that you just listed?
So what they have to do is go see, a clinician, whether it's a nurse practitioner, whether it's a gynecologist, family physician, discuss the symptoms. I mean, what needs to happen is really a good medical history. And then certainly an examination. We can't really definitively diagnose fibroids based on physical exam. We can suspect them, but you really can't tell, say, fibroids from any other reason for the uterus to be enlarged or even an ovarian tumor for that matter. So all roads ultimately lead to imaging, usually in the form of transvaginal ultrasound. And that's pretty definitive. I mean, it's a fairly, reliable test to diagnose fibroids. And then it comes down to what does the patient want in terms of intervention.
All right. So let's get into the good stuff and talk about this procedure that Gynesonics makes called Sonata. What is Sonata?
So Sonata is really a very wonderful instrument that can treat fibroids through the cervix. It is not major surgery. It does not require an inpatient stay. It is similar in that regard to when we treat fibroids with a hysteroscope, which is a big telescope that goes in through the cervix, and we can see fibroids in the endometrial cavity and also indenting the cavity. And we can, with the hysteroscope, remove those fibroids. The problem with that approach is that it's very limited. I mean, I love operative hysteroscopy, but we can only treat fibroids we can see with our eyes through the hysteroscope. So we're completely limited to those fibroids that are either inside the endometrial cavity or that are essentially just under the uterine lining. And even then, many times we have to have patients come back to remove more of those fibroids if they're somewhat deeper, kind of like an iceberg, because we can only get the part that's, above the ocean, essentially. And so that's not very convenient for patients, but more importantly, we can't treat deeper fibroids. And about 60% of fibroids tend to be what we call intramural fibroids. They're within the wall of the uterus. They're not pushing into the cavity. And we can't really approach those hysteroscopically. What's nice about Sonata is it has built-in ultrasound. What it does is we insert this device into the endometrial cavity, just like we do a hysteroscope, but we're not limited by, our field of view in terms of our eyes. We're seeing everything on ultrasound, and we can see all these deeper fibroids, and then we can insert a series of needle electrodes into the fibroid under ultrasound guidance built into the system and essentially ablate the fibroids with radiofrequency energy. Radiofrequency energy is what was used in that device I was talking about from the 90s. It's just this goes one step better. We're not trying to magically find a blood vessel feeding that fibroid. We're essentially destroying the fibroid tissue itself with that same energy, radio frequency energy, but we're doing it with ultrasound guidance built into the system, It's actually a very high resolution ultrasound because we're much closer to the pathology. We're closer to the fibroids than we are even when we do transvaginal ultrasound. It's fairly straightforward for gynecologists to master. It has now been used in either just about 6,000 or a little more than 6,000 patients worldwide, which represents probably 18 to 20,000 fibroid ablations, possibly more than that. And it's been a pretty safe and effective device to date. We've been approved in the US since 2018, but we've been approved in Europe for a much longer period of time, dating back to late 2010. And that's where the initial experience was, in fact, with our system.
So since it's been in Europe since 2010, how many procedures did you say have been performed already?
Approximately 6,000 or more.
Okay. Because in the US, most people, I would say, most patients haven't heard of this procedure. So I would say it's a relatively new procedure, although you said it was FDA approved in the United States when?
Around 2018.
Yeah. But the issue is, even though it was FDA approved in 2018, we're just hearing about it now because it seems like insurance lags behind. And it's just now becoming mainstream because although it was FDA approved, it's just now getting covered by insurance companies.
Correct. And you know, we have a great team that has really worked on this very heavily. And we now have well over 200 million covered lives in the US with, you know, United now covers us, Aetna covers us, most Blue Cross Blue Shield plans cover us, Centene covers us. So, I mean, we have really all the heavy hitters at this point, which I think is really good. There's more work to be done, but we're definitely getting there. I think that, you know, one of the reasons why it's only now becoming more widely known as a procedure is because we really, I think, as a company, spent a lot of time doing a lot of study, getting papers out there in the evidence-based literature. I mean, we now have literally 49 papers out there. We've done 14 clinical trials or, you know, sub-studies or sub-analyses. We see a lot of people doing their own trials now on this system, which is really good. So it's gradually diffusing out there. You know, I think one reason that we're starting to hear a lot more of it is also from patients, because patients, I think, are very attuned to some of the real advantages of this procedure. And the procedure is formally known as transcervical fibroid ablation, or TFA, but the device is a Sonata system. And patients actually, similar to hysteroscopy, recover very quickly. So usually patients are, you know, only in for like an hour or two after the procedure, just for observation. They go home. They usually return to normal activities within, you know, 2 days on average. But about half of the patients when we studied this actually went back to normal activity within 1 day of the procedure, which I think is pretty remarkable. So
This is a hospital procedure right now. People are asleep for this procedure.
Well, not necessarily. A lot of our procedures are done in the hospital, mostly for reimbursement purposes. That can change, which I think will be good, because what we're also seeing is some physicians are doing this in their offices. Some physicians are certainly doing this in ambulatory surgery centers or day surgery centers like that. But what's really cool is this is something that's not limited to general anesthesia. You can have this with general anesthesia, certainly, but we do a lot of procedures with conscious sedation. So where an anesthesiologist or a certified registered nurse anesthetist will simply sedate the patient. And so they can be actually somewhat awake during this procedure, just not feeling any pain. We've also seen this done with regional anesthesia, so spinal anesthesia, epidural anesthesia, just like, you know, in obstetrics. But I think while we haven't really seen this yet in the US, I'm very excited by the fact that several of my colleagues in the United Kingdom are doing this now with just local anesthesia. I did not think that was going to be feasible. I've done a lot of transcervical procedures in a procedure room setting under local anesthesia, and there are patients for whom that works great, and there are patients for whom it's, you know, you start to feel like you're an axe murderer afterwards as the physician. I saw this with my own eyes 2 summers ago in England, and patients not only have very low pain scores after this, but they actually walk from the procedure out of the hospital. Not even the 15 minutes we give patients after we give them a COVID vaccination. I've never seen anything like that in my life. So it's very well tolerated. They have treated fibroids up to 8.5 centimeters under local anesthesia in England. I think we still need to figure out who's most appropriate for this and who's really not appropriate for this. But I think this is also a potential option down the road.
Yeah, probably
it's not,
similar
it's just
to
not a very painful procedure.
You mentioned it's radio frequency ablation. So if people don't know what that is, it's very similar to probably the most popular endometrial ablation or NovaSure ablation, which a lot of people are familiar with, is having an endometrial ablation. So it's very similar energy that you're using to, or the same energy to use to ablate the fibroids. And so since you said it's transcervical, that means nobody gets any incisions on their abdomen. You don't have to enter the abdomen. What size fibroids can be treated? Or who's a good candidate for this procedure? Obviously people with fibroids, but are there specifics about the characteristics of the fibroids?
Absolutely. And thank you for asking. So I think this is something that really should be a consideration by gynecologists for any patient with fibroids, especially those who don't want a hysterectomy. In fact, one of my former residents when I was an attending at Pennsylvania Hospital, who's now one of our biggest users in this country, she's down in North Carolina, Dr. Leslie Hansen-Lindner, she actually tells her colleagues Sonata should be the default option until proven otherwise. I like that sentiment, but I think we all know that everything we do as gynecologists has some limitations, and this is no different. So in theory, we can treat fibroids up to about 10 centimeters. We want to get as much of the fibroid ablated as possible, but as a minimum floor, while there's not a lot of evidence in the literature on this for radiofrequency energy, it seems that about if you get 50% or so of a fibroid's volume ablated, that patient should get long-term symptom relief. And we've seen patients where, when we studied it, through 3 years, they only had an 8.2% reintervention rate, which means that, over 90% of patients for the first 3 years of treatment don't need to have anything else in terms of surgical reintervention. And we did another study a bit smaller in terms of the number of patients, but with much longer term follow-up beyond 5 years, and found only an 11.8% reintervention rate at more than 5 years. So fairly durable treatment if you get most of the fibroid ablated. As much as you can is certainly a good idea, but you don't have to get all of it because, again, it's not a malignancy. But our longest ablation is 4.9 centimeters long. So we could get about the radius, about 50% more or less of a 10 centimeter fibroid. I think that's more aspirational. I think that for the average physician doing this, I think it's best to stick with 8 centimeters or smaller. The probability of long-term success, I think, is greater. It requires fewer ablations. It is going to be more tolerable for a lot of patients if they're not under general anesthesia, for example. Obviously, shorter procedures are better. But this is also something where the GnRH analog drugs can be very useful, because we can give things like Lupron, Elagolix, for example, for 3 months, shrink fibroids by as much as 50% in most studies I've seen, and now take a 10 centimeter fibroid and get that fibroid down to something much more manageable with Sonata. So there are lots of ways to approach this.
That's great. So as a gynecologist, up until these types of non-invasive procedures came aboard, the options for fibroids we mentioned, certainly hysterectomy was one. If it was in the uterine cavity or the space where a baby grows, you could, there are procedures to shell those kinds of fibroids out. But otherwise, if the fibroids were in the muscle of the uterus, a lot of times we just didn't do anything about that. So it's great that there's an option. The other procedure that gynecologists would do is something called a myomectomy, of cutting into the uterus and shelling it out. Could you talk about maybe the pros and cons of why somebody would have a myomectomy and cut the fibroid out versus having this Sonata procedure?
Sure. So in those occasional patients who have a lot of fibroids, I think my record when I did myomectomy was somewhere around 60 or more fibroids. I think probably most gynecologists can claim that. Because
I've never heard of that kind of thing.
Back in the day, I mean, because we didn't have any other good options back then. But certainly for someone who has a lot of fibroids, I think myomectomy is probably one of the better options, that or uterine artery embolization, depending on what they want to do as far as childbearing, et cetera. So myomectomy certainly works. It's a standard operation. It's been around for a very long time. But that also means we know a lot about it in terms of what some of the downsides are. The downsides are it is still major surgery at that point. And you're talking about cutting into the uterus, having to suture the uterus back up. Again, all of us can do it. It's not that big a deal, but that has implications for the patient. Anytime you're doing that, you're going to cause scarring in the abdominal cavity, which can impact fertility. It can cause pain. In rare cases, it can cause a bowel obstruction. That also can cause scar tissue inside the endometrial cavity. Again, huge impact on pregnancy potentially if someone wants to get pregnant down the line. If someone gets pregnant after myomectomy, we typically advise that the patient have an elective C-section. So we're really, to a large extent, condemning that patient to having a C-section in the future to avoid uterine rupture. So myomectomy is a great operation for sure, but it's not a completely benign operation. It does require incisions unless we're talking about just taking those fibroids that are in the cavity with a hysteroscope. And certainly has longer term implications, and certainly abdominal scarring. I think having a transcervical procedure where we're going through a natural orifice is always going to be preferable for patients. Recovery is much faster, anesthesia is much more varied, no incisions, we don't have to worry about wound infections, for example, or wound separating. Just a lot of benefits whenever we can do that.
There's another minimally invasive treatment on the market. It's called the Acessa procedure. Did I say that right? Acessa, yes. Accessa. And it's a laparoscopic ablation of fibroids. How is this different from that?
So it's different, I think, in a few fundamental ways. Obviously, you know, TFA with Sonata is not a laparoscopic procedure. We're never in the abdominal cavity. We're not cutting into anything. It's just very different. As a laparoscopic procedure, Accessa requires general anesthesia always. There really are no other options. The other thing is, I think Accessa is very well positioned because it's coming through the endometrium, through the abdominal cavity into the uterus. I think it's really, you know, a good option potentially for those occasional fibroids that are large on the surface of the uterus or on a stalk outside the uterus. Because fibroids that are on a stalk, we're not going to approach with Sonata. It wouldn't be safe to go outside the uterus to get them with energy that way. Whereas with a laparoscopic procedure, absolutely. I don't think they're as well positioned to treat fibroids that are close to the endometrial cavity. And those, unfortunately, are the ones that predominantly cause bleeding. Bleeding is the one, you know, if not the leading side effect of fibroids, one of the leading side effects of fibroids. I mean, you know, patients have, you know, horrific bleeding in many cases, and they can't effectively treat a lot of those fibroids because they have to go from the outside of the uterus in. They can treat those. I mean, they certainly did in their studies, but they didn't actually meet their FDA required bleeding endpoint. And I suspect that may be one of the reasons for it, because they're coming from the outside in. We're, you know, right there in the endometrial cavity. It's easier for us to treat those fibroids that are most responsible for bleeding. And I think, you know, our sweet spot would be, you know, something that is not excessive sweet spot, let's just say.
I would think another indication would be for those people who had already had an endometrial ablation, but are still having symptoms with fibroids, because the cavity can be scarred.
Correct.
What are your thoughts on, you know, there's some medications that can be used for heavy bleeding associated with fibroids. Can those be used in conjunction with Sonata or before Sonata, or how would you recommend? I know a lot of physicians listen to this podcast too, about talking to patients should I take the medicine? Should I have a procedure?
Certainly. So, I mean, just to, you know, for full transparency, I really believe that women do much better when they have choices. And, you know, the more choices that they have out there to treat fibroids, it's a better world. It just is. So I'm not going to say anything bad about any fibroid treatment that's safe and effective. And certainly medical treatment such as, you know, elagolix, Lupron, Goserelin, Myfembree, et cetera, are very effective treatments for fibroids in the short term. And what I mean by that is, when you put a patient on one of these GnRH analog drugs, they no longer have periods while they're on the drug. That certainly helps with abnormal bleeding. It does shrink fibroids with some caveats. It does shrink fibroids. Problem is, they can't stay on these drugs forever. They can only stay on Lupron, according to the FDA, for 3 months before a surgical procedure. They can stay on a drug like elagolix or relagolix for up to 2 years if they are also on what we call hormonal add-back therapy. The problem with these drugs is that they're putting a woman into a temporary pseudomenopause, and they have all the symptoms of menopause, including osteoporosis, if they're treated for more than 6 months without this add-back therapy of an estrogen and progesterone. So they can be on these drugs for 2 years, but then they have to come off these drugs. And when you come off these drugs, the fibroids, which were not eliminated, they were not destroyed in any way, they were just sitting there kind of in suspended animation. Now they can regrow, and they do. When patients are on add-back therapy, it can certainly help with symptoms. It definitely prevents osteoporosis, which is a great thing, but it blunts any impact of the GnRH analog drugs on fibroid volume reduction. So fibroids actually don't necessarily reduce in size when they're on these drugs with add-back therapy. In some cases, they actually can grow. So that's probably not the best option for someone who has bulk symptoms, for example, from a fibroid, and you want to shrink that down to relieve some of that pressure. But certainly for 3 months of use before treatment with Sonata, it can be a very useful thing without add-back therapy, of course, because it can reduce fibroid volume to a point that it makes either treatment with Sonata possible in the first place, or just, you know, more feasible.
Yeah, I mainly use those drugs more as for patients from a timing perspective. Mm-hmm. you know, I really don't want to have surgery this summer, or I'm going on a big trip, or I just got this new job. And so I need something in the, or maybe they have significant anemia and we need to build up their blood count. So more as a bridge type of therapy before a procedure. Let's talk about expectations of, you mentioned briefly, like, well, what do people feel the day after and then the next day? And then also what can they expect on when they can anticipate an improvement or resolution of their symptoms?
Great question. So this is a process, unlike myomectomy or hysterectomy. It's not a global therapy, unlike hysterectomy or embolization. I mean, we're focusing on individual fibroids, but we're not removing any tissue. So for patients who really would like to just be, you know, get this over with, have, you know, much, you know, like almost immediate resolution of their fibroid symptoms, bulk symptoms, et cetera, this is not the right procedure for them, because this does take time, like a GnRH analog, like embolization. It takes about 3 months for the maximal amount of, for the majority of the fibroid volume reduction to take place. We certainly see it get even better by 12 months out, but just like with the drugs, just like with embolization, most of the fibroid volume reduction takes about 3 months to happen. We get about, on average, 54.7% reduction in fibroid volume at 3 months and 66.6% on average at 12 months, which is really good. But it takes time. So patients need to be aware that this is not something where next week your symptoms are absolutely gone for sure, no problem, as with myomectomy or hysterectomy. On the other hand, they get the benefit of something that's transcervical, minimally invasive, no incisions, very little downtime. And in some cases, we certainly have heard from patients where after one menstrual cycle or after two cycles, their bleeding is remarkably better. That's very wonderful to hear, but I don't expect that from the average patient. I would expect 3 months, certainly. You know, I think all of us have had patients over the years where, you know, if they have an ectopic pregnancy, a tubal pregnancy, which is very dangerous. I've had patients where they'll say, look, I want this dealt with now and I want to get on with my life. So how about you do a laparoscopic procedure to remove it? Absolutely. Also had patients who said, I would really prefer, you have an option, doesn't involve surgery. That's great. I really prefer that, even though it may take a month for this to resolve and you're going to have to do a couple of blood tests along the way. I'm good with that. And so we give them methotrexate for that. This is really for those patients who understand it's a process, who don't expect or need immediate results. And at the same time, they get a much quicker return to normal activity and they can get back on with their life, just knowing that it may take, you know, weeks to months for the fibroids symptoms to completely go away or get significantly improved.
What about risks of the procedure?
Great question. So like everything we do, it has risks. This is something where I think that when I first heard about this, I've been with Gynesonics now since 2008. And when I first heard about this, the first thing that went through my mind, and I'm sure it goes through every gynecologist's mind, and I think to a certain extent it kind of should, is could this injure bowel or bladder, anything outside the uterus? Because we're heating fibroids, we're using energy to destroy fibroid tissue. And that, I think, has always been my biggest fear. It has never happened. I mean, this has actually been proven to be a very safe procedure in the hands of gynecologists in academic settings, mostly in community-based settings, you know, small private practices, every gynecologist type you could imagine. This has been a very safe device. We have never had a bowel injury. We've never had a bladder injury. And a lot of that is because this is really the only fibroid ablation system I know of that shows you two things. It shows you where the ablation is taking place. It's all done graphically. Gynecologists don't need to calculate anything. They don't need to input any numbers. It is about as gynecologist proof as you could make this, basically. Very straightforward. So you see where the ablation is going to take place. You can make it bigger, smaller, further out, closer in, all that. But we're also the only fibroid ablation system that actually has a safety border. That is key, because we know there's still some heating that goes on beyond where the ablation is taking place. Not enough to injure myometrium, which is the muscle layer of the uterus, not enough to injure a fibroid, right? But I don't want it on bowel. I don't want it on bladder. Bowel is much less forgiving than you know, the muscle layer of the uterus. So we have a very conservative and heavily validated thermal safety border that's about 40% more conservative than we really need it to be. And I'm good with that. That's one of the main reasons why this procedure has been so safe in the hands of a wide variety of gynecologists on both sides of the Atlantic. The other thing is we have a team of clinical specialists, almost all of whom are sonographers. And again, this is something that I think any gynecologist can master. I'm going to confess, I trained in Boston back in the day, and none of us, I think, came out of there, unless we did a fellowship in high-risk obstetrics, with, you know, a huge level of confidence and expertise in ultrasound. I certainly didn't. So if I could figure out what I'm seeing with this, any gynecologist can. But that said, we do have a team of clinical specialists in the room for the initial cases. They are there to provide support, guidance. And that is also, I want to call them out because I think they do an amazing job of really supporting the physicians as they're starting out doing this. But then eventually the physicians get independent fairly quickly, and they don't need anyone. Just like, you know, you teach someone to drive a car, after a while they, you know, they get their license, they shouldn't need you there in the car with them. So it's a very straightforward procedure for the average gynecologist to perform.
Yeah. And although it's a relatively new procedure for gynecologists, the device is new, the technique behind it of inserting a device into a uterus, those are skills that gynecologists should have been doing or should be very yes. comfortable doing. So I think it's a very safe procedure, even for gynecologists that are still in the learning curve, because although the device is new, the moves behind it are something we're all used to.
Agreed.
And then my last question is why do you think hysterectomy is still just the go-to for a lot of gynecologists?
So I've pondered this for a long time because that's been one of my interests. And you know, it's interesting because the great British gynecologist Victor Bonney in, I think it was 1931, said that, you know, there's no question myomectomy is a much better operation than hysterectomy because we're treating a condition. We don't have to take out the organ. Isn't that great? And then in the 60s, in the leading journal of our specialty in obstetrics and gynecology, someone wrote, and I have this paper, that, you know, the uterus is a potentially cancer-ridden, disease-ridden, problematic organ that once a woman is done with her childbearing should just be removed. This is a peer-reviewed major journal in our specialty. And then when I look at the copy of operative gynecology that I have from my residency days, and it says in there very clearly that, you know, it's unusual not to be able to do something else besides hysterectomy for fibroids, but hysterectomy is what most gynecologists feel comfortable with. So that's what they're going to do. And I'm insulted by that as a gynecologist, because I feel that they're saying you're not good enough as surgeons or as physicians or as human beings to do the right thing for your patient. I think that's bad. I just do. I think that gynecologists need to get out of that mindset. I'm stunned that in 2023 we still have to have this discussion. But you know, the truth of the matter is we do live in a time where we have many good alternatives to hysterectomy. And again, it should be a woman's choice. There are women who say, look, my mother had a hysterectomy, my mother's mother had a hysterectomy, I'm done now. Please just do a hysterectomy. And of course, but it shouldn't be imposed upon them by a physician for a benign condition when we have many other options. So I don't really understand it. I think it's that a lot of physicians in all specialties are very slow to change their practices. They do what works for them. Hysterectomy works for them. They don't really have to think about it. Myomectomy, you have to think about. Transcervical fibroid ablation with the Sonata system, you have to think about. Hysteroscopic myomectomy, you have to think about. Even drugs, you have to think about. So I think once people start, you know, being a little more patient-centric, I think we're going to see fewer hysterectomies and hopefully more things like Sonata that provide really good choices for women.
Yeah, that was really well said. I couldn't agree more. I think that's one of the things I just love about medicine is it's always changing. But, you know, there are a lot of doctors out there that, you're right, just don't want to change. But, you know, if you and I didn't change, like, we would be stuck with the only tools in our toolbox of, at least for me, abdominal hysterectomy and vaginal hysterectomy. Like, all of the things that I do now, I never learned in residency. So, anyway, I think that pretty much hits it. I think, as far as I'm concerned, we covered everything there is to know about Sonata. Did I miss anything?
No, just that you know, we certainly have a you know, a lot of resources online for physicians and also very importantly for patients. I think it's www.sonatatreatment.com. Certainly the Gynesonics site has links to it. And I really appreciate this opportunity to talk about this great hysterectomy alternative.
Thanks for listening to Healthy Her. If you enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a quick 5-star review on your podcast platform. Your feedback means the world to us and helps others discover our show. Do you have questions or want to discuss a particular topic? You can reach us by emailing ask@dramiebrenner.com or calling 513-204-8403 and leaving a voicemail. We might feature your question or comment in an upcoming episode, so don't miss out on the chance to be a part of the conversation. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any of our upcoming episodes. We appreciate your support and can't wait to have you back with us next time. Take care and remember, your Healthy Her journey begins with you. This podcast is for general information only and does not constitute medical advice, the practice of medicine, nursing, or other healthcare services. No patient-physician relationship is formed. The information in the podcast and any references, material, or links are at the sole discretion of the listener and not meant to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Listeners should not delay or disregard obtaining medical advice for any medical diagnosis or issues that they may have and should seek medical care or advice from their healthcare provider for any such conditions.